This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, September 28, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, world leaders call for action at the UN as fighting and protests continue in Syria. The U.S. government increases its use of warrantless surveillance of phone calls, emails, and other communication. And we'll take a look at the threat to voting rights in this year's election with journalist Greg Palast. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In Philadelphia, a state judge today overturned the sentence of death row inmate Terrence Williams, who was scheduled to be executed early next week. From Philadelphia, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo has more.
Terrence Williams was convicted for a murder he committed during a 1984 robbery. He was 18 at the time when he killed a 56-year-old man who he says had repeatedly sexually abused him. Williams had been sentenced to die next Wednesday, but a Philadelphia Common Pleas Court judge today overturned that sentence. Defense attorney Sean Nolan says the judge focused on the district attorney's decision to hide evidence that Williams' victim sexually abused him and other teenage boys.
And they did not turn that evidence over to the defense. And what she found is that that would have changed the verdict at the penalty phase and that the jury would not have voted for death if they had known those things.
The DA could file an emergency appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court or accept the decision and go to a new death penalty hearing. The DA could alternatively allow a life sentence to be imposed, as had previously been done in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
A court in Louisiana has exonerated a man who had been on death row for 15 years. Damon Thibodeau walked out of prison today after forensic and DNA evidence cleared him in the rape and murder of a young relative. The ACLU says his conviction was based almost entirely on a false confession to police. More than 7 years after Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, thousands who lost their homes and were temporarily sheltered in formaldehyde-riddled FEMA trailers are finally getting some closure. FSRN's Zoe Sullivan has the details.
In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, FEMA trailers were used to house displaced Gulf Coast residents. The trailers were sold to the government by private companies. In the months following the storm, residents began complaining about health issues. Testing found formaldehyde levels in the trailers that exceeded federal safety limits. Formaldehyde is a carcinogen and can cause respiratory and other health problems. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Englehart approved a $42.6 million class action settlement. Most of the money comes from trailer manufacturers. The settlement is reported to resolve almost all the remaining claims on the issue and makes approximately 55,000 Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Texas residents eligible for payouts. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
Next Wednesday, President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney will debate for the first time. The economy and jobs are sure to be major focuses, but environmental and health groups are lobbying moderators to broach the issue of climate change. These organizations delivered 120,000 signatures to debate moderator Jim Lehrer yesterday from people who think President Obama and Romney should clarify their positions on climate change and their ideas for dealing with it. Mike Palamuso is with the League of Conservation Voters.
Many voters are going to be tuning into this presidential race for the first time during these debates. So even if these candidates are discussing these issues on the campaign trail, it's important for this to be front and center on the national stage during this first presidential debate.
Palamuso says the conversation should expand beyond statements of belief or disbelief in the science. He says candidates should also address energy policy in light of changing climate conditions. The Austin City Council has endorsed marriage equality, making it the first city in Texas to support same-sex marriage. The six-person board passed the resolution unanimously Thursday. Although largely a symbolic gesture, the resolution criticizes the Defense of Marriage Act and calls efforts by Texas to prohibit marriage recognition for same-sex couples discriminatory and inconsistent with Austin's commitment to equal rights. The final resolution simply states, "We support marriage equality in the state of Texas." Saudi Arabia is sending home more than 1,000 Nigerian women it detained as they tried to make the pilgrimage to Mecca. Saudi officials held the women because they did not have a male escort. In protest, the Nigerian government issued a 48-hour suspension of all pilgrimage flights from its airports. FSRN's Samuel Okocha reports from the Nigerian capital.
Before now, the rule requiring a woman to be accompanied by a male guardian, known as a mahram, appeared to have been relaxed for Nigerian pilgrims who face no such requirement under Nigeria's secular government. But current affairs analyst Yinka Salam tells FSRN that the rule had always been enforced. It says before now, the number of Nigerian women pilgrims equaled their male counterparts, giving the impression of supervision. This time, however, more than 1,000 female pilgrims arrived in Saudi Arabia alone. Earlier this week, Saudi authorities sent 171 female pilgrims back to Nigeria. More followed today. This prompted the government to suspend pilgrimage flights to Mecca, where more than 2 million Muslims from around the world are expected to gather in late October. Some say for years in order to make the Hajj, which Muslims are required to complete once in their lives. Some of the deported women have complained of poor detention conditions and humiliating treatment by Saudi officials. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Syria, protests and fighting continued across the country today. Activists said more than 120 people were killed, mostly from aerial shelling in Aleppo, Damascus, Hama, Homs, and elsewhere, according to the local coordination committees. Raids and arrests took place in Damascus as well, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, when Syrian regime forces swept through neighborhoods in the Barza area. People also took to the streets in protest in several cities. In a video posted online today that was identified by activists as coming from Idlib, a column of people marched through the street carrying signs and chanting. One banner labeled with today's date reads in English, "We assure the world that we who make the final sacrifice will never be beaten." At least one child can be seen marching in the crowd. 2,000 Syrians are fleeing across borders every day, a total that could exceed 700,000 by the end of the year, according to figures updated Thursday from the UN's Refugee Agency. It said 75% are women and children. In Geneva, the UN Human Rights Council voted today to extend a 6-month term for a commission that is charged with collecting evidence of abuses. The evidence could be used in prosecution cases in the future. The conflict in Syria and the world community's efforts to find a peaceful solution featured in several world leaders speaking at the UN's General Assembly debate in New York today. Kenny Anthony, Prime Minister for the Caribbean island of St. Lucia, pressed for the UN to take action.
We continue to support the efforts of the Special Envoy and of the Secretary General in this body's efforts to induce the parties to focus on coming to the table for negotiations, with a view to finding a path towards a resolution of the conflict which is acceptable to the majority of the people of Syria and takes into account the necessity to ensure the welfare and interests of minorities in that state.
UN General Assembly debate closes next week in New York. The U.S. government has drastically increased its use of warrantless surveillance of phone calls, emails, and other communications over the past few years. That's according to Justice Department documents obtained this week by the American Civil Liberties Union. It took months of lawsuits to make the documents public, but there is still a great deal the public doesn't know about the spying activities of law enforcement agencies. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Between 2009 and 2011, the number of people whose telephones were the subject of non-content surveillance more than tripled, peaking at nearly 50,000 subjects last year. During that same period, Justice Department authorizations to use this monitoring power on email and network data increased 360%. In total, more people were subject to this type of surveillance in the past 2 years than in the entire previous decade. Christopher Segoyan with the ACLU explained what the documents obtained this week reveal.
Police at the local state levels and then federal agencies like the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, Customs, Immigration, Secret Service, all of these agencies routinely request extremely private information about large numbers of American citizens some of whom are later, you know, investigated and prosecuted, but many of whom are never charged with a crime.
The two types of surveillance reported are pen register for outgoing data and trap and trace for incoming data, including phone numbers, the date, time, and length of calls, the to and from addresses of email messages, and some information about websites visited. The terms originally applied to physical devices that were attached to people's phones, but now the government just asks phone and internet companies to hand over the routinely stored data. The Justice Department is required by law to report to Congress on these surveillance activities every year, but they've instead tended to publish it every 4 or more years in what Segoyan called a document dump. And when they do give the information to congressional committees on time, those committees sometimes keep it from the public.
This is something that they could certainly put on a congressional website, or DOJ could put online if they wish to do so, but they just haven't bothered to put the reports online. This is the kind of thing that Congress or the executive branch should be proactively releasing to the American people.
The government calls this kind of surveillance non-content because it doesn't capture the telephone conversations or the bodies of emails themselves. Unlike a wiretap, which requires a warrant from a judge based on probable cause, the privacy protections for trap and trace and pen register are much looser. Law enforcement officials only have to submit a form to a court saying the surveillance is part of an ongoing investigation, and no judge reviews the merits of the claim. And when it comes to the rapidly evolving social media world, the government definitions of non-content are vague.
It's not entirely clear where the line between content and non-content is. So, for example, if someone sends you a friend request on Facebook, we don't know whether that's considered content or non-content. We don't know whether your list of friends is non-content or content. We don't know if someone pokes you or likes something on a social networking site, whether that is content or non-content.
Yet some civil liberties advocates, including Thomas Jefferson Law School professor Marjorie Cohen, say even gathering non-content data violates people's privacy rights.
This content-non-content distinction makes a mockery of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. Non-content information can still be very, very invasive. It reveals who you communicate with in real time, and it also reveals private details of your life.
One problem, she says, is that our laws regulating electronic communication have not kept up with the rapidly changing technology. But a bill crafted by New York Democrat Gerald Nadler could change that. The Electronic Communications Privacy Modernization Act, introduced in August, would make all federal agencies, and state and local law enforcement, disclose their non-content surveillance activities to the public.
That would give the public a window into what kind of surveillance is taking place and by which agencies, and we have a right to know that.
The House of Representatives could take up the bill when they return after the November election, but it may have to be reintroduced next Congress. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In this year's election, watchdogs and civil rights groups are raising concerns about the effects of restrictive voting laws and measures in key battleground states. One of the people closely watching these developments is Greg Pallast, who covered Catherine Harris's purge of black voters from Florida's voter rolls in the 2000 presidential election. Pallast's new book is called Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. And he joins us now on the line. Greg Pallast, welcome to FSRN.
I'm really glad to be back with you.
You begin your book with some startling numbers from the 2008 election first, that around 2.7 million ballots cast were not counted. What happened?
Wow. Yeah, I went into the raw statistics of the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission. They actually keep a count of not only the votes, but the non-votes. And so that's an official number, 2,700,000. In fact, the exact numbers are right in there. Why? We have 1.4 million votes cast and not counted because they're so-called spoiled. 700,000, three-quarters of a million provisional ballots cast and not counted. And we have 488,000 absentee ballots, which are quite legit, mailed in and thrown in the garbage. It's spoilage. That's what they call spoilage. Now, it wouldn't matter if it were random. It wouldn't matter if it were minor. But the official count from the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, if you are African American, the chance your vote will spoil, that is, you'll vote it, but it doesn't get counted for some technical, goofy reason, is 900% higher than if you're white. So if 900% higher for African-Americans than white people that you're about will go into the garbage can, 500% higher than white people if you are Latino, and if you're Native American, which is, by the way, an extremely important concentrated vote in the swing states. I mean, it's just off the chart. It's literally, we couldn't calculate, it's just off the charts. So you basically, the votes in the dumpster in America are from voters of color.
And that's just from this method you're describing called spoiled ballots, almost 1.5 million ballots from the 2008 election that we're talking about.
And then we get to things, really complex systems like caging, where Karl Rove, the operation, under contract with the Republican National Committee, sends out letters to voters, first class. The letters come back, and when the and they say, do not forward the letter. When the letter comes back, they call it caged. They challenge the voter as voting from a fraudulent address.
You also outline several other strategies, or actually nine in the book, that work to suppress vote or remove voters from lists or block people from accessing the ballot. We've talked about caging. Now, one of them also is purging, and that's removing voters from the rolls in the first place. Give us an example of how this is done.
Well, actually, most people know me as the guy that uncovered how Catherine Harris purged tens of thousands of black folk off the voter rolls in Florida back in 2000. If you look in Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, I actually show the new Florida list. And I have a guy who committed a crime, Robert Moore. So they have a computer algorithm that hunts for Robert Moore in Florida. Now, there's a few Robert Moores, don't you think, in Florida? And one, by the way, one of the tricks here is that African Americans have common names. Share a lot of names together, you know, so there's a lot of African-American Robert Moores. So there is, but they go wider than that. They remove the vote of Bobby Moore, because they say, trick, Robert becomes Bobby. Well, that's B-O-B-B-I. Mr. Robert Moore commits the crime, and Mrs. Bobby Moore loses her vote. That's the trick. And that's the stuff that's going on.
Now, behind this effort and efforts of groups like True the Vote, which started in Texas and now has chapters nationwide, is the threat of illegitimate or fraudulent voters. You know, in Pennsylvania, there's an ongoing court case, and proponents could not produce evidence that it was a significant problem when they were arguing for the voter ID law there. How often does this actually happen?
Okay. I spoke to Dr. Tova Wang, who was hired by the government to investigate this. And Professor Wang said that the probability that a voter will commit fraud, like steal someone's ID and vote in their name, is less likely than being hit by lightning. And I calculated it myself. It's 60 times more likely you'll get hit by lightning than commit voter fraud, for the obvious reason that you put down your name, address, and you show up. It's pretty easy to nail you, and anyone who does get caught, and there are an average of 6 people in the United States a year who commit this crime. So 6 fraudulent voters, they knock out 6 million legal voters a year. So the fraudulent voter is the new sleeper cell, the new red menace, the new yellow peril. They're coming to get us. They're swimming across the Rio Grande to vote in your school board elections. It's the biggest crime wave in American history, if it's true, but it's not. It's a fake. It's false.
Investigative journalist Greg Palast's new book is Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. It also features comics by Ted Rall and an introduction by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. For more details, go to ballotbandits.org or fsrn.org. Greg Palast, thank you for joining us.
You guys are terrific. Thank you.
This week, the Department of Labor released its annual reports on child labor and slavery around the world. The studies required by Congress found 3 new countries that are using child labor: South Sudan, Suriname, and Vietnam. Workers' rights groups say the increasing demand for cheap labor and pressure to weaken labor protections overseas hampers efforts to eradicate child labor. FSRN's Andrew Oxford reports.
Out of 74 countries believed to be using child and forced labor, the U.S. Labor Department says only two, Brazil and Chile, have made significant advancement towards eradicating the practice. Around the world, 56 countries made minimal advancement, while 27 made no advancement at all.
While most everyone agrees that this kind of abuse is morally wrong, it continues to happen.
Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis announced findings from the three reports in Washington on Wednesday.
There's still so much that we have to do to put an end to this kind of abuse, and we need to take a deeper look at the issues that contribute to that. And poverty, my friends, is the primary reason why children are forced to work.
More than 215 million children are working worldwide, according to the study. That includes 6 million children forced into sex slavery or debt bondage. In addition to an international survey, the Department of Labor also published two lists of goods from different countries believed to be manufactured using child or slave labor. Cotton, sugarcane, coffee, garments, footwear, and gold were the products most frequently produced by children or slaves around the globe. China and Myanmar ranked among the nations with high numbers of such laborers, even as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced on Wednesday that the United States would ease trade restrictions against the Southeast Asian country, also known as Burma. The appearance on the list of so many nations whose names are stitched into clothing labels or etched into products across the Western world is the result of increasing reliance on contract labor and the informal economy, according to workers' rights groups. Neha Misra is Senior Specialist on Migration and Human Trafficking at the AFL-CIO's Solidarity Center.
The demand for low prices and cutthroat prices puts pressure all along supply chains to have cheap labor. And what's the cheapest form of labor but children? And so I don't think it's just the economic crisis, although that's probably exacerbated it. I think it's an economic model that unfortunately corporations are using and that worker rights groups are trying to fight back against.
Empowering workers and ensuring governments take their rights seriously, Misra says, may be one of the most effective ways of eradicating child labor. The U.S. report says that while the International Labor Organization's treaties on child labor are among that agency's most ratified, governments are not living up to their commitments to eradicate the practice by their target date of 2016. Andrew Oxford, FSRN, San Antonio.
Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters to you. You've made a commitment to listen to the progressive, fearless, independent journalism we produce daily. With 200 freelance journalists around the globe, FSRN is on the ground where crisis occurs and where the news of the day affects local communities. We've led the way in covering many critical issues, from the effects of state laws on undocumented immigrants and the battle for voters' rights.
I know that this law would have a devastating effect. It has already had devastating effects. It's going back to the Jim Crow days.
To the attacks on women around the world and the response to climate change on the grassroots level.
Say no to this idea of a green economy. That is not real. That is a false solution as well. Economy cannot be green. It's just twisting around capitalism.
No one else can bring you this coverage the way we do. Find out more about how to support FSRN, a choice that matters, by going to our website, fsrn.org.
The country of Georgia is holding parliamentary elections next Monday. Some have described them as a litmus test for democracy and the presidency of Mikhail Saakashvili, who has struggled to respond recently to videos showing abuse of prisoners in the country. But as FSRN's MJ Del Valle reports, some people in Georgia have expectations focused on much more basic issues, such as joblessness, poor health care, and inadequate pensions.
These are the most disputed elections since current President Mikhail Saakashvili and the United National Movement Party came to power with the Peaceful Rose Revolution in 2003. The main opponent is the Georgian Dream Coalition, led by billionaire Vitsina Ivanishvili, whose fortune is almost double than the country's budget. Ivanishvili is running on a platform based on a liberal economy, social solidarity, and improved relations with Russia. Saakashvili's campaign has used his accomplishments to attract voters. In Tbilisi, teacher Veronika Geladze says some things have improved since Saakashvili came to power.
Things have changed a lot since the Rose Revolution. Before, you could not go outside after midnight. It was too dangerous. Now it is very safe, and you can see people strolling late at night. There is no corruption now. For example, before a university, you could just buy a degree. Now it is different.
Light and modernistic buildings have become symbols of the new Georgia. But for people in some villages, the development is not so visible. That's the opinion of taxi driver Baliko Ineshvili. He speaks from Tbariliant Kari, a village of around 100 people.
Here they are not building anything, only main roads when elections are coming. But the quality is very poor. If a tractor goes there, the road will be damaged because it won't put up with the weight. And those are the main roads. On secondary roads, they have not done anything.
Since the Rose Revolution, inequalities have deepened between town and country. That's visible in Tanitkari, a small village of about 50 families. These are the days of the wine harvest, and the scent of fruit and alcohol fills the air. Retired musician Lavrenti Tanishvili has some farm animals and an orchard here, but he says it's not enough to get by and he misses the old times.
I am retired. My wife sells yogurt in Tbilisi. We are living in difficult times. What can we do? We were better off under Soviet rule. Prices of petrol and sugar have increased a lot.
According to a 2011 report from the Carnegie Endowment, inadequate government spending on agriculture led to an increase in food imports. An estimated 80% of the country's food comes from abroad, which has led to high food inflation. Tanishvili and Ineshvili say that during Soviet times sugar and wheat were very cheap, but that their cost has doubled, even tripled since then. The Carnegie Endowment report, citing internal European Union data, states that cultivated land in Georgia decreased by more than 40% between 2002 and 2009. Additionally, wheat production fell by more than half. Ineshvili says whoever wins the election needs to pay attention to farmers.
We are asking this government, or the new one, that every person has a chance to live freely. Income and pensions must be good enough to buy medicines and have an operation if one needs it. Keep some chickens at home, or else, so I can afford to welcome guests. I want to guarantee that we are going to have enough money, bread, salt, sugar, and we have everything a farmer needs.
The minimum retirement pension in Georgia is $66 a month. The current government has increased pensions, but Ineshvili says this is not enough.
Pensions have gone up a bit, just $9. That's nothing. An old man like me needs a minimum of $90 just to eat.
The country is also struggling with unemployment, which is 17% according to official figures. But the number could be higher. Those living on subsistence farming and poor self-employed people are not included in this figure. MJ Del Valle, FSRN, Georgia.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.